burner in a neat row with the others. It's what Myers uses. I think he goes through several each month.
Smart guy. When's the last time you talked to him?
A few weeks back, the day he gave me this phone. An exotic Asian girl appeared to take their orders. Gunther ordered tea and encouraged Lacey to order a glass of wine. This was a ritual they had gone through 100 times. She would do nothing to tempt him, but he took pride in being beyond temptation. Besides, he had never been a wine drinker. Too mild, too civilized. Lacey asked for a glass of Chablis. They decided on a plate of crispy spring rolls to start with. When the drinks arrived and they were comparing their latest conversations with their mother, Anne, one of the phones made a soft noise. Of the impressive collection in the center of the table, it was the least expected. Myers was checking in. Lacey sighed, hesitated, then said, "I guess I better take this."
"Of course. And you can take the check, too."
She slowly opened the phone. Glancing around as she did so, and quietly said, "This better be good." A strange voice replied,
"I'm trying to find Lacey Stoltz."
She hesitated again, certain that it was not Greg Myers. "I'm Lacey. Who is this?"
"We've never met, but we both know Greg. I'm the intermediary, the middleman, the guy who handles the mole. We need to talk."
This was so wrong that Lacey's lungs froze and she felt faint. Her face must have registered horror because Gunther reached over and gently touched her arm. "Where's Greg?" she asked.
Gunther's eyes narrowed with concern. "I don't know. That's what we need to talk about. I'm in town, not far from you. How soon can we meet?"
"I'm having dinner.
2 hours, then. Let's say straight up 10 o'clock. Between the Capitol and the old Capitol building, there is a courtyard. I'll meet you at the front steps there at 10.
"What is the danger level right now, if I might ask?"
"Right now, between the two of us, I'd say there's no immediate danger."
"Okay. But I'm bringing my brother, and he likes to play with guns. Should he bring one, just in case?"
"No, Lacey. We are on the same side."
"Has something happened to Greg?"
"We'll talk about it later."
"I've lost my appetite. I'll be there in 30 minutes. The Capitol grounds were well lit and a few other pedestrians were milling about. It was, after all, Saturday night, and all state workers were enjoying the weekend. The lone figure near the steps of the old Capitol was dressed in shorts, sneakers, and a baseball cap, and would not have attracted attention anywhere in town. He took one last drag of his cigarette, stepped on the butt, and walked to them.
"You must be Lacey,"
he said with an outstretched hand. "I am. This is my brother, Gunther."
"My name's Cooley," he said, as everyone quickly shook hands. He nodded and said, "Let's walk."
They strolled without purpose across the courtyard in the direction of the House Office Building. Cooley said,
"Don't know how much you know about me. Probably very little."
"I've never known your name," she said. "What's going on?" By then, she knew something had happened to Greg. Otherwise, Cooley would not be in the picture and they would not be meeting.
Cooley spoke softly as they walked. 4 days ago, Myers and his girl Carlita were in Key Largo scuba diving.
"I met Carlita."
"They docked, and he said he was going to a bar to meet someone. He walked down the pier, and she stayed on the boat. He didn't come back. After a few hours, she began to worry. Around dark, she noticed a couple of strangers looking at his boat from a distance, or so she thought. The harbor was busy, lots of boats and folks partying on the decks. and the two men didn't stay long. She called me that night, as was our contingency plan. Needless to say, she's distraught and frantic and has no idea what to do next. Greg rarely went ashore, and when he did, she knew exactly when he would return. They bought supplies here and there, but Carlita usually did the shopping. They would venture off to a movie or a restaurant, but always together. Greg was careful and planned his movements. They were on Duval Street, drifting away from the capital. Just three friends out for a stroll on a hot night. Lacey asked, "What about his phones? Laptop? Files? Records?"
"There's some stuff on the boat, still being watched by her. Frankly, I don't know what's there. He doesn't know the identity of the mole. He and I talked either face-to-face or on disposable phones, careful not to leave a trail. But he's a lawyer, right? So there's the chance that he's got notes and records. For now, Carlita's staying put and waiting. Waiting for him to return, waiting for me to tell her what to do. I can't run the risk of going there."
"Could they identify you?" Lacey asked.
"Want to take a crack at who they might be?" "No, I don't think I could be recognized in person, but who knows? I can't go get her."
"And she can't move the boat?" Gunther asked.
"No way. She can't even start the engines and put it in reverse. And where would she go?"
Lacey noticed a bench and said, "I'd like to sit down."
She and Gunther took a seat. He held her hand, as coolly lit another cigarette and watched the traffic. No other pedestrians were close.
Lacey said, "Greg's story was that he'd been living on the run for several years, that he'd made a lot of enemies when he got in trouble. Could that part of his past have caught up with him?"
Cooley blew a cloud of smoke. "I doubt it. We met in prison. I was once a lawyer, too, until they asked me to leave the profession. So we were just a couple disbarred boys doing time in a federal joint in Texas. From another con, I heard the story of Von Dubose and the Indian casino. So when I got out, I came back to Florida and started sniffing around. It's a long story, but I knew the mole and got that ball rolling. Now it looks pretty foolish. You've been hurt. Your buddy is dead. Myers is probably drifting with the currents, 100 feet down with a brick around his neck."
"You think it's Dubose?" Gunther asked.
"He gets my vote. Sure, Greg had enemies, but that story goes back a long way. And I know some of the people he squealed on. They were not organized crooks. Sure, they screwed up, but they're not the type of people who'd spend years looking for Greg so they could put a bullet in his head and further complicate their lives. Kubiak, the ringleader, is still serving time. Now Greg signs his name on the complaint and threatens the Dubose clan. And lo and behold, within a matter of days, he's vanished."
"A procedural question?"
Lacey shrugged. "Whatever." "Can the formal complaint Myers filed against Judge McDover go forward if the complaining party disappears?" Lacey thought about it for a moment.
"I'm not sure. To my knowledge, it's never happened before."
"Are you sure you want it to go forward?" Gunther asked.
Neither Cooley nor Lacey responded. Cooley slowly finished his cigarette and casually flipped the butt onto the sidewalk. A thoughtless act of littering that she might have said something about. Now, though, it was unimportant. "What's our priority?" she asked.
Cooley said, "Carlita can't stay on the boat much longer. She's low on food and water, and the harbor master is pestering her for docking fees. I'd like to rescue her some way and secure his stuff, phones, files, anything that needs protecting. But again, it's just too risky. There's a good chance someone is watching and waiting."
"I can do it," Gunther said.
"No way," Lacey said, surprised.
You're not getting near this.
Listen, I have a small plane at the airport. I can be in Key Largo in 2 hours. They, if they are really there, have no idea who I am. Carlita will know I'm coming, so she'll be ready. She'll tell us exactly where the boat is located. I'll be in and out before anybody knows what's happening. If they wake up and somehow manage to follow us to the airport, there's no way they can scramble a plane fast enough to chase us. I'll drop her off somewhere along the way, and she can catch a bus to wherever she wants to go.
What if someone tries to confront you? Cooley asked.
You heard my sister, sir. I like guns, and I'll have one in my pocket. I don't frighten too easily anyway.
I don't know, Gunther, Lacey said. Cooley was quickly warming up to the idea.
Lacey was not. We're going to do it, okay, sis? It's low risk, high reward. I'm doing it to help the team and to protect you.
Chapter 27 Geismar nixed the plan late Saturday night. He was furious that Gunther had once again managed to stick his nose into the McDover affair, and he scolded Lacey over her breach of professional discretion. She pushed back as much as possible by explaining that Cooley had called during their dinner and there was no way to hide it from her brother, who, as they well knew by now, had big ears and was quite pushy. She reminded her boss that he himself had told Gunther far too much over coffee in the hospital while she was still in a coma. This was not their typical investigation, and it required different rules. The much larger issue was Myers's disappearance and all the sticky issues it created. Lacey insisted that they meet early Sunday morning at BJC. Geismar eventually relented, but insisted that Gunther not be present. So her brother waited in the car, barking nonstop on the phone at a banker he'd pulled out of bed. Geismar had slept off his anger and was willing to listen. Lacey relayed the latest news from Cooley. He had spoken to Carlita early that morning and there had been no change. Certainly no sign of Myers. She was bustling around the boat as if all was well, cleaning the deck, washing windows, trying to make things appear normal, and really doing nothing but watching the movements of everyone in sight. She was heartbroken, terrified, stranded, and ready to go home to Tampa, but had almost no money and no plan. She had gone through Myers's papers but was not sure what was relevant. There was a box of his legal stuff under the bed, but he kept most of his papers somewhere in Myrtle Beach. There were also two phones and a laptop. Cooley promised that help was on the way, but said so only to keep her calm. Lacey argued that they had an obligation to rescue her, if it could be done without too much risk. Obviously, her situation was a direct result of their investigation. At the moment, there was no one else in a position to help her. She had possession of records, phones, and a laptop that could be damaging. Gunther was admittedly a loose cannon, but he was willing to fly down and back at his own expense. Otherwise, the drive was at least 10 hours one way. Time was crucial. More than once, Lacey said, "Michael, I'm not taking no for an answer."
"Why can't she call the police and report him missing?" he argued. "Let them handle it. She can leave the boat with whatever she wants to take and go home. If a crime has been committed down there, then the police need to know about it."
Cooley mentioned that, and it frightened her. Not sure why. But then we don't know everything about Myers and his boat. Maybe she doesn't want the cops poking around. Maybe she's undocumented.
"Tell her to destroy the files, anything that looks suspicious, keep the phone she's using and toss the other one, along with the laptop, overboard."
"That sounds nice and efficient, sitting here in your office, Michael. But we don't know what she knows. And you could be asking her to destroy evidence. Anyway, she's not going to do that. She's terrified and she doesn't know what to do. We need to help.
If she leaves, what happens to the boat?
Who cares? The cops will eventually be called, I guess. At some point, they'll decide there is a missing person involved, and they'll do whatever they need to do. We have enough problems of our own.
You're not going, Lacey. I'm not running the risk of you getting hurt again.
Okay, then Gunther can handle it by himself. He can fetch Carlita and get her off the boat.
Do you really trust him?
Yes. In certain situations, he can be quite reliable.
Michael was clearly troubled. Another casualty. Perhaps Myers left something crucial behind. BJC had no experience in matters such as these. Where were the real cops?
He took a sip of coffee from a paper cup and said, You know, Lacey, if DuBose is behind this, then they know that the complaint against McDover was signed by a guy who has been neutralized. Game over, Lacey. We cannot proceed without the complaining party.
Let's worry about that tomorrow, please. Right now, we need to get Carlita and whatever Myers might have left behind.
It's over, Lacey.
No, it's not. And I'm not taking no for an answer.
So I've heard.
Here's an idea, Michael. You and Gunther buzz down to Key Largo together and get her. The weather is perfect. He says the airplane holds 4 passengers. An easy trip.
I don't like small airplanes.
You don't like big ones either. Man up, Michael. You'll be back before you know it. We're not breaking any laws here. Just a quick flight down there, get her, drop her off somewhere, and you're back home.
And I'm stuck with Gunther for 4 hours in a small airplane?
I know, but you know it's important.
Why bother, Lacey? This file is about to be closed.
Not if the FBI gets involved. When they find out a key witness has vanished, they might change their minds.
Sounds pretty desperate.
That's because we are desperate.
Michael took a deep breath and shook his head in frustration.
I can't go. We're having a small party for my mother-in-law this afternoon. It's her 90th birthday.
Then I'm going. I swear we'll be safe. Look, it's just a nice little flight on a beautiful Sunday. It's my day off. If I want to go flying, who can stop me?
I'll authorize you to go on one condition. You cannot get near the boat. If someone is watching, then that someone might recognize you. No one knows Gunther, but that's not the case for you. Make sure you get possession of Myers's papers, phones, and laptop. She knows you, and she'll trust you more than your brother. Who wouldn't? Anyway, drop her off along the way, give her some money for a cab or a bus, and make sure she understands that she talks to no one.
Lacey was already headed for the door.
Got it, Michael. An hour later, they lifted off from the Tallahassee airport in the Beach Barren. Gunther, seizing the moment and thrilled with the adventure, sat in the left seat and flew the airplane. Lacey, with headphones, sat beside him and was captivated by the chatter between the controllers and the traffic. They headed almost due south and were soon over the Gulf. At 9,000 feet, they leveled off and hit their maximum speed of 230 miles per hour. The din of the piston engines eased somewhat, though the cabin was far noisier than Lacey had ever experienced. After 2 hours, they began to descend, and Lacey took in the view of the ocean and the islands. They touched down at 11:40. Gunther had called ahead for a courtesy car at General Aviation. He drove and Lacey navigated from a tourist map. Cooley was still somewhere around Tallahassee and talking to Carlita. As they approached the Key Largo Harbor Marina, Cooley gave Gunther her number to facilitate the pickup. The harbor was busy with sailors heading out to sea and fishing boats arriving with their morning catches. A dive boat had just docked, and a dozen divers were unloading their gear. Lacey stayed in the car and watched everything as Gunther strolled along the dock,
just killing time and admiring boats. Carlita stepped off the conspirator and managed to smile as if all was well. She had three bags, a backpack, a nylon sack stuffed with what appeared to be clothing, and Myers's olive courier bag. Gunther grabbed two of them, and they casually walked back to the parking lot. In the car, Lacey scanned the entire marina and saw no one who appeared to be watching them. Carlita was thrilled to see her, a familiar face. Gunther, always quick with an opinion, believed that after 5 days with no contact whatsoever, the people responsible for Myers's disappearance were long gone. If they had wanted to chat with Carlita or rummage through the boat, they would have made a move before now. An hour after leaving the airport, they returned to General Aviation, quickly loaded the Baron and took off at 1:15. Lacey called Geismar, but he did not answer. Must be partying with his mother-in-law. She sent a text saying the mission was accomplished. Lacey and Carlita sat in the rear of the cabin, close together. Once airborne, Carlita began crying. Lacey held her hand and assured her she was now safe. Carlita wanted to know if Lacey had heard anything about Myers. No, there had been no word. Nothing at all. What would happen to the boat? Lacey said she wasn't sure. The plan was to notify the authorities that Greg Myers was missing and let them go about their business. She quizzed Carlita about the boat. How long had she been living on it? Where did Myers buy it or lease it? Did he own it outright or was a bank involved? Did anyone else ever visit them on the boat? She knew very little. She had been living on it for about a year, but knew nothing of where it came from. Myers, she said, did not talk about his business. Occasionally, he would go ashore to meet someone, but always returned within an hour. He was extremely careful and fearful. He did not make mistakes. When he disappeared, he was just going to the marina for a drink. Nothing more. He was not supposed to be meeting anyone. He simply vanished. When they leveled off and Key Largo was far behind, Carlita stopped the tears and grew quiet. Lacey asked if they could keep the courier bag and the backpack. Carlita said sure. She wanted no part of his paperwork. She said Myers had been careful about what he left on the boat because it could be searched, either by the bad guys or by the authorities. Using the postal service, never the overnight delivery services, he'd sent a lot of paperwork to his brother in Myrtle Beach. She was not sure what he'd left behind on the boat, but was pretty sure it was not important. An hour later, they landed in Sarasota. Gunther had called ahead for a cab, and Lacey handed Carlita enough money to get to her place in Tampa. Lacey thanked her and hugged her and said goodbye, knowing she would never see her again. Back in the air, with Gunther occupied with flying, Lacey opened the courier bag. She pulled out Myers's thin laptop and turned it on, but was stopped at the passcode. She found a prepaid cell phone and some files. One contained the boat's registration to a company in the Bahamas, along with warranties, operating procedures, and a thick stack of fine print about insurance. Another file was filled with old cases involving corrupt judges. Lacey found not a single word about McDover, the Tapacola, Cooley, the Mole, or herself. The backpack was just as clean. Nothing but old research and newspaper clippings about Ramsey Mix, a.k.a. Greg Myers. Evidently, he kept the current materials somewhere on shore, at least the written ones. She suspected his laptop was loaded with evidence that could have been devastating in the wrong hands. When they landed in Tallahassee, Lacey was hoping Gunther might simply stay on the plane and continue back to Atlanta. Apparently, that never crossed his mind. As they drove to her apartment,
It became clear that Gunther now considered himself an active member of the BJC investigative team. He planned to stay a few more days, to keep an eye on his sister. Lacey called Geismar again with a full update. They agreed to meet early Monday morning. Late in the afternoon, as Gunther paced around her terrace, calling one partner or lawyer or accountant or banker after another, Lacey was returning emails when she got a surprise from Ali Pacheco. His text was simply, "Got time for a drink?" She responded, "Unofficial after hours, no business?" He replied, "Of course." But business was exactly what she had in mind. She invited him to her apartment, warned him that her brother was there and that things would not be that private. Pacheco arrived in shorts and a polo at 7:30. Lacey poured him a beer and introduced him to Gunther, who wanted to grill him. The unofficial status of the little rendezvous lasted for about 5 minutes until Gunther blurted, "We gotta talk about Myers." Pacheco put down his glass, looked at Lacey, and asked, "Okay, what's up with Myers?"
"He's been missing for 5 days," she said. "That's his laptop on the counter. We got it off his boat this morning in Key Largo."
"It's a long story," Gunther said.
Pacheco stared at both of them. He raised both hands, showed them his palms, said,
"This is way off limits, okay? Tell me all you can tell me, then I'll decide what to do with it."
Gunther was remarkably quiet as Lacey told the story. Sipping his second beer, Pacheco finally said,
"The boat needs to be secured, and to do that, the police need to be notified. There's no federal issue here, not yet anyway, so we can't do it."
"But you can notify the police, right?" Lacey asked. "I'd rather not make the call, because then I would have to answer a lot of questions. I'd rather not have my name attached to a missing person case."
"You're already attached to it because you have his laptop and files."
"But they have nothing to do with his disappearance."
"You don't know that. You don't know what's in the laptop. There may be a trail there, some reference to a meeting the day he disappeared." "Great," Gunther said. "We'll give it to you, everything, and you give it to the police. They'll take things far more seriously if they're notified by the FBI."
"That might work," Pacheco said.
"Is there a chance Myers simply walked away? Given his past and his present, that's not completely far-fetched."
Lacey said, "Sure, I've thought about it. Maybe something frightened him. Maybe he got tired of the boat, or the woman, or both, and decided to vanish. He was at least thinking about dropping the complaint. When he came here to my apartment, he offered to drop it and walk away. He was sorry about Hugo, blamed himself, and said he wished he'd never started all this. He could have ditched the records, scrubbed his computer, and hit the road."
"You don't believe that," Gunther said.
"No, I don't. I've had this conversation with Cooley, and he'll never be convinced that Myers would run and hide again. Myers needs the money. He's an ex-con who's 60 years old and without much of a future. He was banking on a huge windfall from the whistleblower statute. He knew that law inside and out and was already counting his money. He believed McDover and Dubose have stolen tens of millions and that a lot of the money can be recovered. I don't know how he paid for the boat, but he was very proud of it. He loved island hopping and puttering around the Keys. He was a happy guy about to strike it rich, so no, I don't think he walked away."
Pacheco said,
"Well, the disappearance is now 5 days old and the investigation has not even started. That makes for an awfully cold trail." "And there's nothing the FBI can do?"
Gunther asked.
"Not really. The locals have to go in first. If there's a kidnapping or something like that, they could call us. But I doubt it. Frankly, I'd say the chances of finding Myers alive are pretty slim.
All the more reason to go after DuBose, Lacey said.
I agree, but I'm not making that decision. How many more dead folks do you need?
Gunther asked.
Again, it's not my decision. Lacey can tell you that I would have jumped in a week ago.
Gunther stormed out of the room and returned to his terrace. Sorry, Lacey said. Pacheco had entered her apartment with thoughts of a pleasant drink with a pretty lady. He left with Myers's courier bag and backpack and no clear idea of what to do next. Chapter 28 Lacey awoke early Monday morning with a new plan to get rid of her brother. It would take a trip to Death Row, a place he would not be welcome. And she would go by herself because the rules at BJC simply could not be bent enough to allow him to tag along. She rehearsed her story as the coffee brewed. She was pleasantly surprised when he appeared freshly showered and fully dressed. Not surprisingly, a deal was collapsing, and he informed her he was needed at home. Indeed, he barely had enough time to devour a piece of toast before they hustled out the door and to her car. At the airport, she thanked him again and made sure he promised to return. As the beach lifted off, she smiled and took a deep breath and was thankful she was not on it. At the office, she met with Michael and described in detail the trip to Key Largo. She detailed the contents of Myers's courier bag and backpack and explained that they, along with his laptop, were in the possession of the FBI.
You met with the FBI? Michael asked, irritated.
Pacheco has the hots for me, and he stopped by yesterday for a drink. One thing led to another, and with Gunther's eager assistance, we got around to discussing Myers. Pacheco agreed to contact the police and report him missing. He thought it best if the FBI had possession of the stuff from the boat.
Please tell me your brother is leaving town.
Already gone. Left this morning.
Thank heavens. Please tell me, Lacey, that he can keep his mouth shut.
Don't worry. No one in Atlanta cares. And besides, he will always do what's best for me. Relax.
Relax? This is the biggest case in our history, and it's collapsing on all fronts. I don't suppose you've heard from Killebrew.
No, and I don't expect to. They have 18 days left to respond, and I'm sure they'll play it cool until the last minute. Any excitement on their part would be premature and might tip their hand. They're too smart to contact us now. The subpoena was served last Friday, and I'm sure they're mulling it over.
All we can do is wait.
I can't sit around, Michael. I'm going to see Junior Mace on Death Row. Just want you to know my whereabouts.
Didn't realize you represented Junior Mace.
Of course I don't. But I promise to visit him. His D.C. lawyers will meet with him this afternoon. Saltzman, the lead counsel, invited me to sit in. Junior doesn't mind. He likes me.
Don't get too close.
Saltzman is confident that it will be delayed. If the snitch comes through and recants his testimony, Saltzman thinks they stop the execution and maybe even get a new trial.
A new trial after what, 15 years?
Something like that.
And where exactly do you fit in?
I didn't say I fit in. Let's just say I don't want to sit around the office all day. Besides, Junior Mace's wrongful conviction is part of the grand conspiracy. If it is set aside, new evidence might be discovered. If we assume the trail leads back to DuBose, then things could unravel. It's important for us to monitor his case.
Just be careful, please.
Death Row is a pretty safe place, Michael.
If you say so.
Lacey closed her office door and retrieved a thick file filled with Sadell's memos. She removed one from the stack and read it again. Titled, The Murders of Sunrus Coe and Eileen Mace. It read, Junior and Eileen Mace lived with their three children in a wood-framed house on Tinley Road, roughly 2 miles from the Tapakola Reservation. At the time, about half of the Tapakola lived on tribal land, with many others scattered close by. About 80% lived in Brunswick County, but some lived as far away as Jacksonville. On the afternoon of January 17, 1995, while their three children were in school, Sunrus Coe paid a visit to the Mace home. Ruz Coe and Junior Mace were friends and had led the opposition to the casino. Junior was driving a truck for a company out of Moorville, Florida, and was at work. If Son and Eileen were having an affair, then the purpose of his visit was obvious. If they were not, then it has never been known what prompted the visit. At any rate, they were found naked and dead in the bedroom by the oldest child when he got home from school at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. A pathologist testifying for the state estimated the time of death at somewhere between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. Junior was known to drink, and after making his deliveries, he returned to the warehouse in Moorville, got in his truck, and stopped by a bar. He had a couple of beers and threw some darts with a man who has never been identified. At around 6:30 p.m., he was found in the parking lot, near his truck, unconscious and presumably drunk. The weapon used in the two murders was an unregistered Smith & Wesson .38 snub-nosed revolver. It was found under the seat of Junior's truck, along with a wallet belonging to Son. Mace was taken to the hospital in Moorville. The police, acting on an anonymous tip, went to the hospital and broke the news about his wife and son. He spent the night in the hospital before being transported to jail. He was charged with both murders and was not allowed to attend the funeral of his wife. He maintained his innocence, but no one listened. At his trial, which was moved by Judge Claudia McDover from Brunswick County to Panama City, Mace presented two alibi witnesses who worked for businesses where he had made deliveries that afternoon. The first witness placed him about 30 miles from the scene of the crime between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. The second witness placed him about 15 miles away. Judging from the trial transcript, neither witness was particularly effective, and the prosecutor made much of the fact that Junior could have possibly made the two deliveries and still had time to stop by his house between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. It was never clear how he could have parked his semi-rig, got into his pickup, drove home, killed two people, then switched trucks again. The state relied heavily on the testimony of two jailhouse informants, Todd Short and Digger Robles. Both testified that they had shared a cell with Junior at various times, and that he openly bragged of catching his wife in bed with another man and shooting both of them. In testimony that was remarkably similar, they told the jury that Junior was proud of what he'd done, had no remorse, and couldn't understand why he was being prosecuted. According to hearsay and local lore, both snitches disappeared from the area not long after the trial. The presence of Son's wallet in Junior's truck was crucial. Under Florida law, a capital case must include murder, obviously, but another crime as well. Rape, burglary, kidnapping, and so on. Thus, the fact that Junior stole the wallet elevated the case from first-degree murder to capital murder. The presence of the gun in Junior's truck was fatal to his defense. Ballistics experts from the state crime lab testified that there was no doubt the bullets removed from the bodies were fired by the .38 caliber revolver. Against the advice of counsel, Junior's defense lawyer was a court-appointed rookie handling his first capital case, Junior took the stand in his own defense.
He vehemently denied any involvement in the deaths of his wife and friend. He claimed he was being framed in retaliation for his opposition to the casino. He said someone spiked his beer at the bar, that he drank only three of them, then blacked out and did not remember leaving the bar. The bartender testified that he had at least three beers, and that he, the bartender, helped Junior to his truck and left him there. On the stand, it appears from the trial transcript that Junior handled himself with dignity, though the cross-examination was lengthy. With the gun, the wallet, two informants, a defense that relied on two shaky alibi witnesses, and a defendant who was apparently drunk and didn't remember much, the jury had enough for a conviction. During the sentencing phase, Junior's lawyer called his brother Wilton and a cousin, both of whom testified that Junior was a devoted husband and father, was not a heavy drinker, did not own a gun, and had not fired one in years. The jury returned two death verdicts. Throughout the eight-day trial, Judge McDover, who was presiding over her first capital murder trial, favored the prosecution on virtually every issue. Only in agreeing to change venue did she show any concern for the rights of Mace. She gave the state's witnesses great latitude with their testimony and continually overruled objections by the defense. With the defense witnesses, she sustained almost every objection by the prosecution. Her handling of the trial has been repeatedly attacked on appeal, and some concerns have been noted in various appellate rulings. However, the courts have continually upheld the convictions. Throughout the 2.5-hour drive to the prison, Lacey's thoughts were on Hugo. Less than 2 months earlier, they had made this trip together, both sleep-deprived and slugging coffee to stay awake. They had discussed their distrust of Greg Myers and their reluctance to indulge his theory of a grand conspiracy. They had admitted the sense of danger they felt. They had been so naive. She entered Bradford County and followed the signs to Stark, then to the prison. It took half an hour to make her way to Q Wing. It was noon, Monday, and no other attorneys were there. She waited in a small conference room for 15 minutes until Junior appeared in chains. His guards unshackled him, and he took his seat on the other side of the plastic wall. He took his receiver, smiled, said,
"Thanks for coming."
"Hello, Junior. It's good to see you again."
"You look good, Lacey, in spite of what happened. I trust your injuries are healing."
"Well, my hair is growing, and that's all that matters." He chuckled at this. He was more animated, more eager to talk. Lacey assumed he was awaiting the arrival of his D.C. lawyers with great anticipation. For the first time in many years, there was hope.
"I'm sorry about your friend, Hugo," he said. "I liked him."
"Thanks." She really didn't want to talk about Hugo. But with plenty of time to kill, they could chat about anything. She said his family was coping and trying to get by, but the days were long and difficult. He wanted to know about the accident, how and when it happened, and what had been learned since then. He doubted it was really an accident, and she assured him it was not. He was curious as to why no one, from the outside, had stepped in to investigate Hugo's death. Careful with her words, she explained that, hopefully, things were moving in that direction. They talked about Wilton, Todd Short, the D.C. lawyers, and a little of life on death row. After a long pause, one of many, he said,
"I had a visitor yesterday, one that was not at all expected."
"Who was it?"
"A man named Lyman Gritt. Heard of him?"
"Yes, we've actually met, though I don't remember. I'm told he was with the rescue team that worked the accident and got me to the hospital.
I stopped by his office to say hello and thanks, but he seems to have been replaced. The timing looks suspicious.
Junior smiled and leaned closer. It's all suspicious, Lacey. Wheels are turning, and you'd best be careful.
She shrugged. Keep talking. He said,
Grit's a good man. He was in favor of the casino, so we were on opposite sides long ago. But we have a history. My father and his uncle were raised together in a shack just off the reservation. They were like brothers. I can't say the families are close now because we fought over the casino. But Grit has a conscience, and he knows about the corruption. He never liked the chief. Now he really despises him and his family. The chief's son is now the constable, so any investigation into your accident will go nowhere. It's all being covered up, as I'm sure you suspect. But Grit knows the truth, and he thinks he has the evidence to prove it. That's why he wants to talk to you.
To me?
That's right. He thinks he can trust you. He doesn't trust the local boys in Brunswick County. Not that they would get involved. As you've probably learned, our tribe is wary of outsiders, especially those with badges. But Grit has some evidence.
What kind of evidence?
He didn't say, or wouldn't say.
These walls have been known to hear too much, so we were cautious. You need to understand, Lacey, that Grit is being threatened. He has a wife and three kids, and the chief and his pals can be effectively intimidating. The entire tribe lives under a cloud of fear, and people just don't talk. Plus, with the casino, life is better these days, so why rock the boat?
Lacey had serious doubts about the prison authorities eavesdropping on conversations between attorneys and their death row clients. But then she realized that the meeting with Grit took place in another part of Q-Wing. Grit was not a lawyer.
What makes him think he can trust me? We've never met.
Because you're not a cop, and you're the first person to set foot on the reservation and ask questions. You and Mr. Hatch.
Okay. How am I supposed to meet with Grit?
Wilton will facilitate it.
So who makes the next move?
Grit and I agreed that I'll contact Wilton and he'll arrange things. That is, if you're willing to talk to him.
Of course I'm willing to talk.
Then I'll get word to Wilton. Needless to say, Lacey, this has to be handled as delicately as possible. Everyone is scared. They're watching Grit, and probably Wilton, too.
Do they, whoever they might be, know that Todd Short is back in town?
I don't think so. My lawyers met with Short this morning, somewhere far away from the reservation. If he follows through with his promise to recant his testimony, it won't be long before everyone knows it. At that point, he'll be a marked man.
They can't keep killing people, Junior.
They killed your buddy, Mr. Hatch, and Son and Eileen. And they probably took care of Digger Robles, the other snitch. May he rest in peace.
And not to mention Greg Myers.
He continued. And they're perfectly willing to let the state of Florida kill me. They'll stop at nothing, Lacey. Don't ever forget that.
How can I?
Saltzman and an associate named Fuller arrived just after 1 p.m. They were dressed casually in khakis and loafers, a far cry from the dark, pinstriped world of D.C. law. Their firm had 1,000 lawyers on all major continents. Its pro bono efforts on behalf of condemned killers were laudatory, even staggering. Lacey had read about the firm online, and was astonished at the manpower it threw into the fight against the death penalty. Their meeting with Todd Short had gone beautifully. The snitch had given a 2-hour video deposition in which he admitted being recruited by the police and prosecutor
to exchange bogus testimony for leniency and cash. They had found him to be believable and truly remorseful. Junior would always hate the guy who sent him to death row, but he was nonetheless thrilled at his change of heart. Saltzman explained that they would immediately file a petition for post-conviction relief in state court and seek a stay of execution. Once that was in hand, they would slug it out with the Florida Attorney General's office and go to federal court if necessary. The flurry of potential litigation was bewildering, to Lacey at least. But Saltzman had been through it many times. He was a seasoned expert in the world of habeas corpus and exuded a confidence that was contagious. His goal was a new trial, one to be held far away from the meddlesome self-interest of Claudia McDover. Chapter 29. The burner Lacey kept in her pocket vibrated early Tuesday morning. Cooley was checking in, if only to inform her that he had not heard from Greg Myers. No surprise there. He also said he had mailed her another prepaid phone and it should arrive later in the morning. When she had it, she was to destroy the one she was holding. For lunch, she met Ali Pacheco at a sandwich shop near the Capitol. Over a bowl of soup, he relayed the information that the police in Key Largo had sequestered the conspirator and it was now safely under lock and key. He would meet with them in a day or so and hand over the laptop, courier bag, and backpack. It was their investigation, not his. But the FBI was promising full cooperation. The police were interviewing regulars at the marina, but so far had found no one who had seen anything unusual. With no photo and only a general description of the missing person, and not to mention a cold trail to begin with, finding him seemed virtually impossible. After a few minutes of business, Pacheco said,
"This soup is okay, but what about dinner?"
"Where are we professionally?" she asked.
"Oh, I think we're on solid ground," he said with a smile. "We're certainly on the same team. Ethically, I'm not supposed to hit on chicks who work for the Bureau, so we're good to go."
"Chicks?"
"Just a figure of speech, no harm intended. I'm 34 years old. I'm guessing you're somewhere in that range. We're both single, and frankly, it's refreshing to meet a nice woman in real life and not on some dating site. You do the online stuff?"
"Twice. Both disasters."
"Oh, I could tell some stories, but I won't bore you. So, how about dinner?"
If she said yes, she would do so only because he was nice-looking and personable, though a bit cocky. But then she had never met a young FBI agent who wasn't brimming with confidence. She would not say yes because BJC was desperate for help. "When?" she asked.
"I don't know. Tonight?"
"And what if at some point the Bureau gets involved with my little conspiracy? Would that make your boss uncomfortable?"
"You met Luna. He's always uncomfortable. He prefers it. But no, I see no conflict. Again, we would be working on the same side of the street. Besides, you've already told us everything. There are no secrets, right?"
"There are a lot of secrets. I just don't know them yet."
"And I won't ask. What about your boss?"
"He's a pushover."
"Thought so. I got the impression that when you're in the room, you're pretty much in charge. Dinner, nice bottle of wine, hell, maybe even some candles? I'll pick you up at 7. Assuming, of course, your brother is not around."
"He's not."
"Good. What a piece of work."
"Gunther is very protective of his little sister."
"Can't say I blame him. 7?
7:30.
And pick a nice place, but not something too fancy. Forget the candles. We work for the government, and we'll split the check.
Deal.
He picked her up in a late-model SUV, one just washed and shined and vacuumed for the occasion. For the first 5 minutes, they talked about cars. Lacey was tired of the rental she'd been driving and ready for a new set of wheels. She loved her old hybrid, but the crash had her thinking of something a bit sturdier. They were heading south, away from downtown.
"You like Cajun food?"
he asked. "Love it."
"Ever been to Johnny Ray's?"
"No, but I've heard it's great."
"Let's try it."
She liked the SUV, but found it a bit on the masculine side. She was curious about its cost. Through some quick research, she had learned that the current starting salary for a special agent was $52,000. Allie had been with the Bureau for 5 years, so she figured they were earning about the same. He had commented on how nice her apartment was, and said he was sharing one with another agent. Reassignment was a way of life in the Bureau, and he was hesitant to buy a place. They waded through the background pleasantries, though each knew the other had dug through the Internet. He grew up in Omaha, college and law school at Nebraska. Off-duty, he had the relaxed easiness of a Midwesterner, with a complete lack of pretension. Her undergraduate degree was from William and Mary, law school at Tulane. They found common ground in New Orleans, where he'd spent his first 2 years with the Bureau. Neither really missed the place, too much humidity and crime, though the way they talked about it now, they seemed downright homesick. By the time they parked and walked into the restaurant, Lacey was giving the guy high marks on every front. "Be cool," she told herself. "They always disappoint." At a quiet corner table, they opened the menus. When the waiter stepped away, she said, "Just a reminder, we're splitting the check."
"Okay, but I would like to pay. After all, I invited you."
"Thanks, but we'll split it." And that was the end of that conversation. They decided to start with a dozen raw oysters each and agreed on a bottle of Sancerre. When the menus were gone, he said,
"So, what would you like to talk about?"
She chuckled at his bluntness. "Anything but the case."
"Fair enough. You pick a topic, then I'll pick one. And anything is fair game. Anything but the casino and all that."
"That's pretty broad. You go first, and let's see how things unwind."
"Okay. I have a great question, and if you don't want to talk about it, I understand. What's it like getting hit with an airbag?"
"I take it you've missed that experience so far?"
"Yes, so far."
She took a sip of water and a deep breath. "It's loud, sudden, jolting. One second it's just sitting there, invisible inside the steering wheel, never to be thought about. And a millisecond later, it's exploding in your face at 200 miles an hour. That, along with the impact, knocked me out. Not for very long, because I remember someone moving around the car. After that, I blacked out. The airbag saved my life, but it's a rough way to go. Once is enough."
"I'm sure it is. Have you completely recovered?"
"For the most part. There's still some soreness here and there, but every day is better. I wish my hair would grow faster."
"You're beautiful with short hair."
The wine arrived. Lacey tasted it and approved. They touched glasses and had a drink.
"Your turn," he said.
"What? You've had enough of airbags?"
"Just curious. I had a friend who was behind the wheel when he swerved to miss a pedestrian. Instead, he hit a utility pole, going about 20 miles an hour. He would have been fine, but the airbag banged him around pretty bad. He kept ice packs on his face for a week.
I prefer to have them. Why'd you go to law school?
My father is a lawyer in Omaha, and it just seemed like the thing to do. I never thought about changing.